Hello and welcome to The Bunker Daily. I am your host, Alex Andreau. The one attribute which most progressives have always grudgingly admired about conservative parties is that they know how to win election. A sort of ruthlessness in their pursuit of power that meant ideology usually came second. It is against this background that I have watched the current Tory party's mitosis into an ever-increasing number of fragments, at times incredulous. My guest today is here to help me try and understand the chaos at the heart of right-wing politics right now. He is a professor of politics at Queen Mary University of London, whose books include the recent title, The Conservative Party After Brexit. Welcome to The Bunker, Tim Bale, or I should say welcome back to The Bunker.
Great to be here. Thanks very much for having me on.
Tim, you write in the book, winning elections does, of course, matter to Tory MPs, but for many of those at the very top of the party, an awful lot of their time and energy is devoted to the next leadership election rather than the next general election. I mean, this couldn't be truer right now. Is this at the core of what we're talking about today?
Well, I certainly think it does have a lot to do with it, yes. It's clear that you can't really understand anything that a top Tory, as the media likes to call them, says these days without thinking about how it will play for them in a potential leadership contest. And I think that would include people like Robert Jenrick at the moment, Kemi Badenoch, Penny Mordaunt, Suella Braverman, Priti Patel, Tom Tugendhat, the list goes on. So, I mean, everything in some ways is a mixture, if you like, of their genuine values. And you have to accept that, you know, there are genuine values held by some of these people. Electoral intuitions, and sometimes they are no more than intuitions. And then, of course, a consideration of where that might place them in terms of the membership, who, of course, have now got the final say in any leadership contest.
Hmm. Of course, the clash of personal ambition and unity has always been true, right? And yet we have never observed such a tailspin. And I think we have never observed this many people openly challenging the leadership, I think, or at least I can't remember this many people openly challenging the leadership at this point of the electoral cycle, especially.
No, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, your point about at this point of the electoral cycle is an interesting one, because normally conservatives, you know, do hold to the precept that, you know, it's best to hang together rather than be hanged separately. But I think, you know, what we're seeing has to do with, I guess, an admission on their part, albeit in private, that they probably lost the next election and that nothing they can do or say now really makes much difference to that. So they may as well concentrate on their leadership ambitions. I do think as well that the big difference with the past, and it's something I've just mentioned, is the move that the Conservative Party made at the end of the 1990s to make the membership the final arbiter of any leadership contest. And that means, I think, for many MPs, their audience isn't simply their fellow parliamentarians, but it is always the membership. In the sense of how they communicate with the membership, that also includes what I call the party in the media. In other words, the newspapers and now perhaps GB News and a magazine like The Spectator, which are the main channels to that membership.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about that because I also sense that various papers and media organizations in that right-wing space have sort of chosen a champion. I occasionally read The Express and I think, gosh, they really love Jenrick. And you know, and you can see this replicated across. Is that another contributing factor, that they all have this sort of magnifying instrument?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, it's clear, as you say, that, you know, some papers favour particular candidates. I have to say that The Express probably isn't the most important outlet. If you're a prospective Tory leader, you really want to be looking for the endorsement of the Mail and the Telegraph, which our survey suggests are the most read newspapers by Tory members. There's also some indications now, at least from the polling done by Conservative Home, of their readers who say they're members, that actually quite a lot of them watch GB News now as well. So some of the positioning goes beyond, I think, those kind of Tory newspapers to that particularly new part and some would say quite pernicious part of what you might call the kind of Tory media ecosystem.
Hmm. Brexit has been put to bed, but it seems to me only superficially. Is it a factor in this unravelling, do you think?
Yes. I mean, I think without Brexit, we wouldn't have seen the chaos, the turmoil that we've seen over the last five, six, seven, eight, however many years it is now.
Yeah.
I think it did destabilise the Conservative Party in the sense that it perhaps put some of the wrong people in charge, Boris Johnson being the obvious example. And it also, I think, strengthened, you know, what you might call the kind of Jacobin tendency, if you like, within the Conservative Party, the ERG, most obviously. And with the success of the ERG in getting a harder Brexit than perhaps many Tories would have liked, I think that has given heart to and inspiration to other groups within the Conservative Party to think that they can hold the leadership to ransom and indeed have a right to do so. So, for example, you know, what we see now, the Common Sense Group or the National Conservatives or the Popcons or whatever they're calling themselves these days. I think, you know, that is a big part of this destabilization and this, if you like, lack of deference towards the leadership that, you know, has been ongoing probably actually since, you know, the 1970s into the 1990s, but has really accelerated, I think, with Brexit.
It also seems to me that there is a more general, more profound ideological struggle. As you say, I mean, I have lost count of the number of groups and families that pop up, only often never to be heard of again, actually, because, you know, they didn't sort of capture the imagination of the media on their launch. What I want to ask is capitalism or neoliberalism, to use that ghastly phrase, really struggling at the moment? Because it just seems to me that, you know, after the financial crisis where, you know, large institutions had to be bailed out, an anathema to classic conservatism, and then the pandemic came and you had furlough and you had a curtailing of liberty, you had the state being forced to be muscular and quite unconservative. And then the next thing that happened was the energy prices, and it seemed to me that the public almost expected government to step in and help with that. Are they struggling to find a sort of political, ideological identity that somehow tallies with where the country is now?
Well, I certainly think that the phenomena that you have just mentioned there have been anathema in many ways to many Conservative MPs and many Conservatives outside of Parliament and obviously in the party and the media as well. I think it is true to say that a lot of what we've seen recently has to do with a kind of nostalgia, if you like, for the 1980s and the Thatcherite revolution and a desire always to go back to that. I think, you know, some of the spending that had to be done by the government during the COVID crisis and obviously during the energy crisis for electoral reasons and indeed for economic reasons is to be regretted by many Conservatives, but seen as inevitable, but now seen as something that they really want to put behind them, allowing the party to go back to the kind of tax cutting agenda that proved so successful as far as they're concerned in the 1980s. But I think what we see increasingly as well is a tendency on the part of people who would regard themselves as economically liberal, neoliberal, if you want to put it, or, you know, fans of the market like Liz Truss, you know, also being actually quite enthusiastic for the kind of populist agenda of, you know, anti-immigration, you know, the war on woke, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, you know, the Conservatives, to coin a phrase of Boris Johnson's, do want to have their cake and eat it. On the one hand, they're a kind of anti-statist party, but on the other hand, they want a big state. And I guess you could go all the way back to an analysis of Thatcherism by someone like Andrew Gamble, the academic, who characterized it as the free economy and the strong state. And I think in some ways, you know, the Conservatives still see that 1980s recipe as a recipe for success.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that. I read a piece that you shared recently. It was in an American context, but I think it applies here too, about how the fundamental difference at the moment between left and right is a sort of vision of the future as opposed to nostalgia for the past, which in many cases never existed. And then I think of things like climate change or, you know, to be more prosaic, the problems we're having at the moment with water companies or with trains. And it seems to me that a lot of people now view that past the 80s as the start of a lot of things going very wrong. So why do the Conservatives expect that voters will respond to their wanting to go back to those times when a lot of the stuff that happened then has been discredited, frankly?
Well, I mean, I think you raise a good point there. And, you know, for many more moderate Conservatives, I think, you know, they do feel that there is a need to, you know, if you like, historicise the 1980s. And in some senses, that's what David Cameron said he wanted to do. You know, that was then and this is now. I think, you know, do still find it very, very difficult to, you know, take off those ideological blinkers. And they're not merely ideological. I mean, those were the glory days in terms of, you know, the electoral success of the party. I think there is and you've put it quite neatly, actually, a nostalgia for those glory days and a sense that that is some sort of eternal recipe for success rather than one that was contingent perhaps on, you know, particular circumstances of the time, i.e. the, you know, the supposed failure of social democracy, the fact that Mrs. Thatcher could rely on huge amounts of North Sea oil revenue in order to do what she did. And, you know, they also, I think, have a rather bastardized, bolderized idea of what Thatcherism actually was, because Mrs. Thatcher was a far more cautious politician than perhaps some people give her credit for, and particularly when it came to the welfare state. Although we used to talk in the 1980s about cuts, there was nothing like the kind of politics of austerity that we saw under Cameron and indeed George Osborne. And to be frank, I think also that the fact that Osborne and Cameron were able to win in 2015 after, you know, a long period of austerity also, I think, encourages some Conservatives to believe that, you know, it is possible to, you know, cut taxes, to spend less and yet still win elections.
The demographic shift that was accepted almost axiomatically, really, in my lifetime, that people get more conservative as they get older, also seems to be appended, at least in the UK. In Europe, there are signs that the hard right is capturing a lot of young people. Mm. But in the UK, certainly, that thing that meant conservatives really were always targeting the exact same group, which was property owning over 40s. And because that group has shrunk and shrunk and shrunk, they have now found that it's simply not enough to get them over the line. What do you think explains that?
Well, I mean, you do make a good point there, because it used to be said that, you know, you could understand British politics simply through the prism of class and all else is embellishment and detail, as the phrase went. Now, age is a really, really important discriminator, and it's probably actually the best predictor of someone's vote, other than perhaps their ethnicity. I think, you know, the failure of the Conservatives to appeal to younger people does have a lot to do with the fact that people feel locked out, if you like, of whatever the Conservative, you know, property owning democracy dream was. I also think, you know, even if you look at the 2017 and 2019 elections, and particularly actually if you look at the Brexit vote, the Conservatives weren't appealing as much to people in work as they were to people on pensions and, you know, particularly homeowners. So I think it's the denial in some senses of what used to be seen as the norm. In other words, people would grow up, live with their parents until their early 20s, manage to buy a property, you know, in their late 20s, or at least at some sort of affordable rent, and then, you know, progress in their chosen profession. I think that has now become much more difficult for younger people. And when I say younger people, I mean, we really are talking about people now up into their 40s at least. And I think that the denial of that dream, I think, is a real problem for the Conservative Party. Now, I mean, it still may be the case that, you know, we're suggesting there is some sort of, you know, demographic time bomb that's going to blow up the Conservatives and, you know, they're never going to get back. I mean, I'm not sure that that is the case. I mean, we've been predicting in some senses that, you know, they've lost young people for decades and decades, and yet still some people seem to come back and vote Conservatives. But they really are in a very serious plight at the moment. I mean, the crossover, at least in the opinion polls anyway, at the moment for somebody voting Conservatives, who's now by age 70. Now, clearly, you can't possibly win an election in the short term on that. And in the long term, unless things change, you are in real trouble.
Yes. And I mean, the solution to some of this stuff is quite obvious. And yet you still get swathes of backbenchers sort of not wanting to get on board with a more intensive building program, for instance. You know, they don't want building to happen on any of the green belt, and even something as simple as the smoking ban, which, yes, it's philosophically complicated, but it's really a very limited policy area, which the Prime Minister made a flagship policy. And then you had 170-odd MPs that didn't back it. And my question is, how does the current cabinet and prime minister put together a manifesto for the next election? How do they bring those groups together in truly contentious things like tax or industrial policy?
I think it is going to be very difficult. I mean, that NIMBYism that you talked about, I think, is really very strong in the Conservative Party. And obviously, that has to do in part with the constituencies which they represent, you know, in the South in particular. You know, there is a great deal of, you know, objection to the building of new housing. And that is a problem, I think, as far as young people are concerned. I mean, putting together a manifesto is going to be very, very difficult. I think, you know, the aim of the Conservative Party at the moment seems to be to try somehow to unite the two halves of the electoral coalition that they put together in 2019. So they're offering up tax cuts to more, if you like, traditional neoliberal Tories who are, you know, quite well off and perhaps living in the southeast on the one hand. And then they're throwing a lot of red meat culture war stuff around to the more conservative but probably less affluent voters that they managed to pull in the north and the Midlands. But to be honest, you know, if we look at the polling anyway, it suggests very strongly that culture war stuff, it might matter a lot to various newspapers, it might matter a lot to, you know, some conservative MPs, but actually, as far as most voters are concerned, it's actually fairly peripheral, and particularly obviously to young people, they really don't understand or sympathize with the whole kind of woke bashing stuff in any case. So even if they get flights off to Rwanda, which you have to see as part of that kind of culture war approach, it strikes me as being very difficult to persuade people that that's more important than, for example, you know, the state of the National Health Service, or in particular, obviously, the economy.
Hmm. Is there also something in the notion that this crop of MPs are simply addicted to the upheaval? You know, there's an entire intake right now. It actually forms a majority since 2015, who are simply not used to being anonymous backbenchers. You know, they want media interviews and to be quoted in the press and to put out outrageous viral videos. Could it be as simple as the fact that this fragmentation, it just feeds individual egos in a much more satisfying way than being united?
Yeah, I mean, I do think, you know, that there is something to that. I think the rise of social media is blamed for almost everything these days. But I do think it does play a part in what we were talking about earlier, which is the destabilization of the Conservative Party and indeed, you know, the lack of deference. I think people now feel, and MPs now feel, as you say, entitled to, you know, their 15 minutes of fame almost every day, if you like. It's always the case, I guess, that many MPs think that they could do as good a job as their leader. And if that leader is the Prime Minister, perhaps the Prime Minister. But I do think that social media has offered people the opportunity to become, if you like, legends in their own lunchtime very, very quickly. I think there is a degree of sort of addiction to the drama. And I think that is going to be actually incredibly traumatic for some Conservative MPs, those who survive what looks like it might be a Labour landslide, in the sense that, you know, they simply don't realise quite how uninterested the media will be in the Conservative Party if they lose very badly. That's exactly what happened after 1997. Nobody cares about you anymore. Nobody listens to you anymore. And I'm afraid that the result of that may be that they make even more extreme statements in the media in order to get attention.
Mm. Can we just spend a couple of minutes also talking about reform? They seem to me not to be angling for a deal for the very first time. Famous words, I know, but what is your sense? And if you agree, why now? Why do they seem to just be determined to plough their own furrow this time?
I think obviously in 2019, when they were the Brexit Party, you know, there was an extent to which they took it to the wire and then decided on a kind of stand down pact in Conservative held constituencies. I think now they really do see the opportunity, as far as Richard Tice anyway is concerned, to possibly kill the Conservative Party. I mean, we have seen the Conservative Party go as low as 19% in the opinion polls, and we've seen Reform rise to 15%. And I do believe that there are some people in Reform who think there will be some sort of crossover point. Now, that may or may not be the case, but the fact is that it's hard to believe that Reform can actually win any seats. But what they can do is so damage the Conservatives that actually the Conservatives end up losing more seats than would necessarily be the case if Reform weren't around. It partly depends, I think, on whether Nigel Farage decides to come back. Now, Nigel Farage's interests and Richard Tice's interests aren't necessarily aligned, I think. I mean, I think when people talk about Nigel Farage possibly coming back after the election as a Conservative and becoming leader of the Conservative Party aren't completely wide of the mark. I mean, I do wonder whether that in the end might be his ambition. And it's interesting, if you look at populist radical right parties around Europe, many of them are actually led by people who were once upon a time members of the mainstream right party. So, for example, in the Netherlands, Geert Wilders, you know, is the PVV, but he was in VVD. And there are others that you can look at who have, you know, gone on that same journey. So it's not entirely impossible to see, you know, the Conservative Party in the end kind of cannibalized from the inside by the populist radical right. And of course, what's happened in some ways to the Conservative Party has to be understood through the prism of its attempt to try and squash any threat on its right flank. The problem, as it is for many European centre-right parties, is that strategy tends not to work, because all you do is end up talking about the very same issues that actually advantage the populist radical right, and in particular immigration. So while I think many Conservatives see this Rwanda scheme as, you know, a kind of magic bullet that might see them be able to, you know, pull back some voters into the Conservative fold by the election, I suspect that's not going to be the case, because it won't do the job that it's intended to do. And in fact, many Conservatives will be disappointed, and as has already happened, think that they may as well go for, you know, the kind of full fat version of a populist rather than the version the Conservatives are offering.
There's also quite a lot of but for Reform splintering the right wing vote, etc. But that smells to me a little of the very familiar fantasy arithmetic that progressives like me engaged in between sort of 2016 and 2019. If the right wing were to come completely together, how strong would it be as an electoral force right now? Because looking at the raw polling data, it still doesn't add up to a lead.
No, it doesn't. And of course, I think you're right to suggest some caveats there, because there are many people voting for Reform who would never in their lives want to vote for the Conservatives, because, you know, they are just outside as far as they are concerned of the establishment. You know, they're protesting by voting Reform. So I think, you know, you can't, as you say, simply add Reform's 15% and the Conservatives 20% and get to 35%. You probably only get into the kind of late 20s, very, very early 30s. And as you say, that really isn't enough for an election win anyway. And then you have to question whether in the long term anyway, there is really much future for the kind of agenda that Reform and indeed the, you know, the right side of the Conservative Party are offering, for many of the reasons that we've already talked about. The fact that, you know, it simply does not have an appeal to younger voters that it has to older voters, and sadly for Reform and for the Conservative Party, I'm afraid biology means that, you know, eventually so many more of those people who share those attitudes are just going to disappear from the electorate to be replaced with people who don't.
One final question then. Do you think there is any possibility of pacification? Listeners will be familiar with what happened to PASOK in Greece, which went in the space of 6 years, went from 49% of the vote to just over 4% of the vote, a sort of catastrophic collapse that simply sees voters move away to other parties.
I mean, it's possible, but I think you also have to look at, you know, what parties actually are. And Reform in some ways is a bit of a, if you like, AstroTurf party, in the sense that it doesn't really have any kind of institutional organization. The Conservative Party, you know, you can mock the fact that, you know, it only has maybe 100,000 or so members now, but it does have 100 or so thousand members. Yeah. It does have some organization on the ground. It does have actually quite a lot of money behind it still. It
probably local councillors.
That's right, exactly. So I think, you know, it's very unusual, I think, for a party to completely kind of implode in that way and for its voters to go to another party en masse. Having said that, of course, this is the 21st century. You know, we are in a completely different era. It is possible, perhaps because of, you know, the power of social media and because the electorate these days are, you know, far more volatile perhaps than they used to be, that, you know, something like that could happen. But I rather doubt it. You know, I'm a bit of a skeptic and a bit of a small C conservative when it comes to party systems. They don't change that often. And in fact, what happened to PASOK is pretty unusual, even in, you know, European politics more generally.
Tim Bale, thank you so much for your time today and for your clarity. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
These conversations that I know you enjoy because you're kind enough to tell me cost money to make, so please consider supporting us from as little as £3 a month on the funding platform Patreon. Just search for Bunker Podcast Patreon. I leave you with the words of columnist Stephen Bush. I think divided parties don't win elections is probably the single least helpful political truism. It's more accurate to say parties which are still divided at election time don't win elections. But a lot of the time in politics, divided is a state you have to pass through to get from incoherent to united. This is Alex Andreu in the Bunker saying over and out.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was written and presented by Alex Andreu. The producer was Liam Tate, and the audio producer was me, Jade Bailey. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.